Thank you very much. It is my pleasure and challenge as they say in baseball, bring up the rear. And we've obviously saved the best to last. That's always the conclusion I come to when I'm put at the end of the agenda. What we're going to try and do is to have a higher level discussion around what's transpired here for the last day and a half. And we're asking our illustrious group of speakers to do the impossible, which is to do a synthetic job of knitting together some of the ideas that we've heard, perhaps to address some of the challenges that have been laid in front of us in terms of ICT4D, whither it goes, and how should we be thinking about this at IDRC. But more importantly, how do we create, and this is something that IDRC enjoys doing, is in fact continuing to build the field of ICT4D research. This is something, as you know, that the field of ICT4D is something that IDRC feels very proud of, and justifiably so. In some senses, it did create the field, and it has built it up into what it is now as a bona fide field of research in many respects. There are graduate programs sprouting all up. The newest one I heard about at the University of Washington, a graduate program in ICT4D. So this clearly has established itself as a field of inquiry. In spite of all the challenges that Mike has tossed down in front of us, we come from a whole variety of different backgrounds. And when I look across the ICT4D team at IDRC, we have a historian sitting down at the end of the table there. We have a graduate from a school of divinity in the team. We have geographers. We actually do have a telecommunications expert, which really surprised me. And we're coming into this with some kind of almost intuitive understanding about what ICT4D is, but that's obviously not good enough. We have to go beyond the intuition. We have to go into the field of objective research that at least we can explain to those who don't have that intuition. And I would say that since 2003, the community of ICT4D researchers has grown probably as fast as the use of mobiles in Africa. It is quite impressive to see the amount of work that's being done in this area of research right now. So something's there. Clearly, we want to preserve it and maintain it and make it grow. And that's really one of the things that I wanted to take away back to Ottawa from this meeting was exactly your thinking around these issues. So we'll follow the same procedure as we have in past sessions. We have everybody's here except Sabri, who had to return, but we'll go through the order in which they are. Sorry? Marcia had to leave as well. That's right. So thank you, Michael. So we'll actually be somewhat lenient then with the 10-minute, but not too much, because I am the moderator. But I noticed that I also am moderating myself, so all bets are off when it comes to me. And so without further ado, we'll start. I'll pass it over to Rohinton.
Thanks, Michael. I think first of all, this is not explicitly a knowledge gap session. It is a summing up session, and that's how I'm approaching it. The value of a discussion like this is not the immediate reaction one has at the end, but the more sort of long-term thinking and acting that it provokes, and the wisdom which is tacit and doesn't always appear right away. So, you know, those are the caveats to what I have to say next. But it really seems to me that this was not meant to be a strictly instrumental discussion about identifying gaps, and that's how I've approached it. And I leave with the view that that's exactly what we have achieved. That said, I have four sets of thoughts which I'd like to share with you. strictly for our own sort of thinking. They don't amount to anything, to be very honest with you. The first is on the motivation of this second conference. And I'm struck by the fact that even in the what has changed section, we've spent a lot of time on what has changed on the ICT side. But when Randy and I, about, was it a year ago, Randy, first thought about might we not do a second Harvard Forum, my own inspiration was how much has changed on the other side of the equation, which is the poverty side. The first forum was explicitly about ICTs and poverty. And we deliberately framed this one as being about ICTs and human development. And even with that wider lens, our understanding of human development is much different and much more profound now today than it was 6 years ago. And many of you have mentioned the dimensions of shame, capabilities, freedom, which were known, of course, but the literature and our thinking about that has changed. I think it was both of those that came to play in this group. The second thought on what has changed was something many of us noted in these 2 days, which is the first forum was about, as one of you said, instrumental discussion. How might ICTs apply here, there, and everywhere? And the example that one of you noted of Muhammad Yunus giving us, which is the women being given cell phones and overnight teaching themselves blindfolded how to use them in creative ways. This time the example was about the cell phone changing national discourse, Amartya's example of the Swat Valley, the cell phone as a game changer. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as we think about ICTs and human development in the future. And I'd like to come back to this in a number of ways. But one is certainly ICTs changing discourse. That is to say, what is their impact and how wide and how deep can it be? The second element here is the one we've all noted and on which we frankly don't know much, and that's exactly as it should be, which is if you take the continuum from data, information, knowledge, and wisdom, there's still a lot to be done, but we do have a more general sense of how ICTs are situated on that continuum and where the weak spots are. And the weak spot continues to be that final straddling from knowledge to wisdom on which ICTs are, frankly, a small element, perhaps an important one. But, you know, society through millennia has been grappling with knowledge and wisdom. And ICTs are not going to change that in particular ways unless we understand what we ourselves mean by knowledge and wisdom. My second set of thoughts has to do with specifics, and there were many, many good streams of thinking that came up. The two that caught my attention were the changing nature of ICTs. They seem to have gone from natural monopolies and how we treat natural monopolies to perhaps public goods, merit goods, club goods. All of these phrases made the discourse either in the 2 days or in the background submissions. And therefore, how you approach their regulation and their expansion is an issue on which there seems now to be more depth. Some of you have noted the recoiling that is going on the regulatory side. But others also noted that, and I thought Ronaldo's example was brilliant, of authorities don't know what to make of land houses. By the way, that one occurred to me. What if people are using land houses to gamble on the internet? Then, in fact, might they be treated as gambling? But that's not the point. I mean, the point is that this different strata of ICTs, cell phones are one. David and others mentioned TV, satellite, the media as others. There is the internet where the numbers seem to suggest stagnation, but shared computing is increasing. I can recall going to my village in Gujarat years ago in what used to be the living room of my grandparents, which was full with 60, 100 people. Why? Because the TV at the time was airing was it the Ramayana or the Mahabharata, Anita, you would recall. And it changed village life. I mean, village life came to a standstill for that hour every week or 2 hours when it was aired. And all of that stuff. And regulating that is a quite different story than regulating the cell phone. And it also strikes me that regulators should be thinking beyond pricing to standards. And finally, it strikes me on this one that the value proposition perhaps, and this is a point Alison and others have made frequently, is we need to understand the political economy of regulation and policy. Perhaps the value proposition is not being articulated as well as some of us as some of us might hope. By which I mean that this is an area in which some version of the Laffer curve probably exists. If you increase access and decrease tax rates, then total revenue is likely to go up, and other good things are likely to happen as well. It's a simple story, but it's one that needs to be made early and often. And I think there's different ways to do that. But it struck me that that's what the regulatory game here is about. In fact, the word regulation is the wrong word to use, and yet that's the lens through which it's being seen. The other subspecific stream that strikes me as interesting and important is the one so many of you have talked about, which is ICT's education equity. We understand that education is the great leveler, but I don't think we quite understand how ICTs play out fully in education, and many of you have made that intervention. I think that's an important one. The third point I'd make has to do with what Amartya said about the unpredictable nature of ICTs, but new technologies and innovation generally. First, I thought Michael's reference to grand challenges was an interesting one. Might there be the equivalent of a grand challenge design in ICT? I mean, we at IDRC might want to think about that. What are the five big grand challenges that we face in this area? But the other thought on this was, when we say something is unpredictable, generally speaking, we don't mean it's completely unpredictable. What we really mean is that the confidence interval around scenarios is wider and wider. That, in turn, leads me to think that we have not thought enough about scenarios. Scenarios is a very sort of businessy, you know, folks at McKinsey and Shell talk about scenarios. Might we talk about scenarios? Might we have scenarios around ICTs and privacy, ICTs and freedom, ICTs and security? Let's assume that there's four or five of these issues that are identified, and might we think in terms of different kinds of scenarios that are likely to emerge, assign a probability to them, and then think them through? But it seems to me that if we've now moved from ICTs and health to ICTs and society, which is that's a big picture debate, then we might want to think about what is it that society is likely to look like and with what probability, and what can we do about that. And my fourth and final thought was something that didn't come up except tangentially in the last 2 days, which is the financial crisis and how that is likely to play out in our field. Anecdotally, about 3 or maybe 4 months ago, we had the head, and you probably would know him, Mike, of a very reputable health economics think tank in China visiting IDRC to talk about their incredible plans for health insurance for all. And he was very lucid, very thoughtful, and perhaps slightly groggy at the meeting. And later in the day, I learned that he had been up all night because his minister had literally written to him, Mike, saying, you know, so there's this big stimulus plan. If your institution's budget increased by 50%, what would you do with it? And get that to me overnight. Nice. And he'd been up, and he still valued, of course, the exchange with IDRC and others in Ottawa and Toronto and Waterloo on because he was after ideas, not money, your point. But the OECD last week put out a report on what innovation systems look like after the crisis. And because it's an OECD report, it's focused on most of the countries that are in crisis, and it's mostly gloom and doom. Investment in human capital is suffering, investment. What if someone did a report on how the financial crisis is likely to play out in countries that have the fiscal space to have serious stimulus packages? Then it seems to me that ICTs are one area, along with others, in which the Chinas and Indias and others are seriously investing. And that's likely to have a huge impact on many things, of which the global supply chain is one. My fearless prediction is that global supply chains in 5 or 10 years will look quite differently than they have traditionally, precisely because of the retooling that's going on during this crisis. And we haven't really thought that one through. And I'm almost convinced ICTs have a role to play in all of that. I don't know what it is. It's simply not in my depth of my thought to do so. And the other area, of course, is one on which Mike and others have also thought about, which is ICTs risk assessment, ICTs and monitoring capital flows, ICTs, does it make a currency tax, whether or not you think it's a good idea or not, does it make a currency tax more feasible or less feasible? There's a window of opportunity to think about these fundamental issues related to global finance. ICTs, I think, have a role to play, and we haven't fully done so. But it seems to me that the financial crisis offers us an opportunity to think about how ICTs will blossom in many countries and then how they might play that role globally. So, a few thoughts.
Thank you very much, Rahinton. Yochai, I'll pass it over to you now. Thank you.
I had no prior agenda, so I will be influenced by my last few conversations more than by anything else, by definition. No anchors. But actually, the conversation I think that we had over coffee just before the break and the last set of interventions at the very end of the meeting, I do think framed for me a good bit of what I heard from my obviously biased listening position. And the story was basically the story that Ronaldo was telling about working with the IDB, I think, on a platform to allow musicians in Brazil to distribute music and essentially build their own labels so that they can. And now, here is where we start lining up all of the various things we've been talking about. So that they can make a living of sorts, and so that they can make music and make meaning, and that they can combine these two things in a system that circumvents the mainstream media recording industry model, which currently prices a digital download in Brazil at $1.50. Given that Brazil is so much wealthier than the United States, it makes sense that it's $1.50 in Brazil and 99 cents or 79 cents in the U.S. Or 49. So obviously that's not a system that is sustainable. But what are several things that were raised by that exchange for me in our conversation? The first thing is that the constant opposition of market versus state, market versus regulation, market versus social organizations is too stark. And that essentially what you're trying to do here is get beyond this, should it be the market, should it be the state, should it be regulation, should it be free market, but rather to see how do we build an integrated model that is open enough for people to innovate in terms of how they do everything they want, whether it's write poetry or live off of it. And that requires a certain set of open platforms at the physical layer, and that requires a consistent push back. So again, part of the story was that apparently the IDB wanted to do this with Facebook, even though the vast majority of Brazilians are using Orkut, and even though Facebook is a more proprietary network. So how do you consistently keep guard against the tendency to lean over and allow the formalization of what is otherwise an informal entrepreneurial model to turn into the capture of these systems by a relatively small number of players. And from my perspective, I don't care whether the players are state bureaucrats interested in exercising political power, with the extreme case being Burma, or company bureaucrats interested in extracting rents with certain incumbents in telecoms or recording industry or wherever you have to on the other end. The pain is completely different in all sorts of ways. We care in the detail a lot. But there are basically tensions between freedom and control. And control can be in the name of markets and profits, and control can be in the name of political power, and freedom can take on all sorts of, and control can be in the name of patriarchy, needless to say. But that creates a whole different set of challenges, because it cuts across so many of the things that we could be counter-control. You could counter, so this was the story you were telling about from Zambia about first come, first serve was the clearest. Because there are certain algorithms we know how to run that are counter-powerful in the domains of state, in the domains of monopoly, but that actually won't do the work in the domains of gender or in the domains of clear class divisions, race divisions. And so that requires a lot of... what that does, though, to be a little less, we're all in this together and it's all lovely, but rather we have disagreements identifying, is it also places a certain onus. I worried, Anita, a bit about the end of your intervention at the very end, which is it also places a pressure on people who see themselves as coming broadly from left intellectual traditions, or at least who sound like they do, to accept that when you talk about pushing up against the state market divisions and society market divisions and looking at complex integrated systems, it's okay for musicians to make money. Oh, no, the poor doesn't need to sit there and be quasi-apologetic. I make money from this when I go and teach people. It's okay to want to keep body and soul together. And back to our lunch conversation about how you do or don't, how central the description of the soul is to what it is that you're trying to say, but we also need to keep body and soul together. And so as a research agenda, I think as a major part of what I heard here was this: let's get beyond, let's set up market incentives, let's set up state programs. There is enormous creativity in populations around the world. There is also an enormous diversity of motivations. I'd also urge us to try to think about not incentives, but motivations, not because of some deep linguistic difference, but because incentives largely come from within the discipline of economics. And so as a practical matter, it orients us towards certain kinds of incentives. Motivations, much more broadly in human behavioral sciences and cognitive sciences, suggest a much broader range and more imperfect range of motivations. They allow us to integrate solidarity and empathy and humanization into what it is that motivates people and finding a sense of meaning, which doesn't exclude the fact that people also want to be able to get up in the morning and eat. And you have to find systems that allow them to do both. And so when you're talking about the artists, and we were talking about, okay, let's sit together and work on some of the research that we've been doing on voluntary donation systems, where you have artists releasing their music freely under Creative Commons license, but in a context that allows the fans to pay. Not forces, allows. And we have 5 years' worth of data showing levels of contribution on the order of $1.29 per song for one Canadian artist, Jane Seabury, of $8 an album, tens of thousands of transactions, average $8 an album, voluntary donation going over to artists. How you build, how you bake that into the system. That leaves us with openness and the fact that we don't know what the systems are for. And that we live in systems, as long as we're focused on policymakers, where it's not okay to be a land house. You're better off being a telecenter, because probably people are coming and doing not serious things. But by doing not serious things, people actually innovate and build things that they care about and they want to do, and that's okay. And we do have a problem of translating from what we learn in the field, which is that people play games, they talk to each other. That's how they learn the skills. They live. And at the same time, they also do the other things. And how we translate that into policymakers that feel that it's incumbent on them not to spend public money on non-serious stuff like games. And maybe you can tell a story about how playing World of Warcraft makes you better at organizing people. Actually, John Seely Brown has a brilliant business-oriented story about the gamer's disposition and why it's more important when you hire someone new into an entrepreneurial business what level they are in World of Warcraft than where they went to business school. It's really very persuasive. Actually, I'll tell a story from Joey Ito, who runs a guild on World of Warcraft. And a kid comes to him, an 18-year-old kid comes to him for advice because he's his guild master about whether or not he should join the army and go to Iraq. Because this is the one adult who's had his back for years now in real context, and he can trust him. Who can he go to? That's serious. So let's get over the market state. Let's understand, I completely subscribe, Rohan, to the idea we need to understand the way in which governance influences and undermines what we can do with development, and we need to understand how the deployment of open information technologies affects governance, and that needs to be central. We need to understand knowledge, creativity, culture as a component of the research agenda and how it integrates across these different platforms. And we need to build, we need to accept that open systems won't always behave the way we anticipate, will usually behave in the way we don't anticipate, and that's a desirable outcome. It just means that we need to find ways of recognizing and embracing those outcomes.
Thank you very much, Yohai. Michael.
Okay. Well, I have enjoyed all of this very much and learned a tremendous amount. And as compared with the last time I was with this group, although I realize you talk to each other all the time, it seems to me not only is there a lot of change in the world, but there's a lot of progress in thinking about a lot of these things. And so that's and a lot of institutional development and so on. And it's natural to focus on the challenges in a forward-looking way. It's the healthiest thing to do. But I think it's also worth noting that, you know, it felt to me before like we were speculating about something that we were dimly seeing in a cloud before. And now it seems to me there's quite a good grip on many of these things. So I you all know my biases. I've been thinking about the kind of economic side of growth and development. And so I wanted to sort of say a few things that relate to that and ICT4D. I'll try to be brief. I want to endorse the notion of incentives. Milton Friedman, whose philosophy not everybody agrees with, did one really important thing in his life that's completely general, which is he repeatedly made the point that, you know, starting with a problem and figuring out what you're supposed to do to get there in a system that has a lot of people won't work unless you pay attention to the incentives. That is, because they are going to go off and do whatever they're going to do. And we fail that test in policy all the time in multiple dimensions. We have now in the global economy a huge deficit in aggregate demand on the order of $1 trillion because the American consumer has semi-vanished, right? This is in game theory terms, this is a game in which the Nash equilibrium isn't very good. Nash means non-cooperative. And so we have a massive problem that we may or may not solve, I'm kind of pessimistic, of sort of coordinating a response so we don't go to the Nash equilibrium. The Nash equilibrium is going to be an attempt to grab market share in a deficient aggregate demand environment. And who's going to win that game is going to be the powerful. And who's going to lose that game are the ones that can't compete. independently of whether the private sector does it or the public sector does it. So I'd cite that as an example, you know, in which using relatively straightforward concepts and attention to sort of notions of incentive, one can sort of put some structure around some problems and bring some focus, some attention, make the problem seem more immediate. I want to talk a little bit about, what I would call focus, faith, and measurement. and I'll do that. I hope this seems relevant once I'm done. I believe that the problem of measuring the impact of the broad things that you're interested in is too hard to solve, and that you should not get hung up on that. And let me give you an example. In 1949, the communists took over China, and they did a better job than any developing country has ever done in educating people, at least up through elementary school. So in the pre-reform period, which was not what occurred in 1978, China had literacy rates for men and women that were approaching 90%. And absolutely nothing happened that was even vaguely interesting economically. Why? Because a whole lot of other things have to happen in order for progress to be made. And they weren't happening because they were mismanaging the economy. And then they changed. And then this thing that was a potentially valuable asset turned into a crucial asset and is one of the foundations of growth at 9% or above. What I'm trying to say is you can have a lot of progress in an area that enhances people's freedom, improves their education, improves their access to services, but if something else is missing, this isn't quite what an economist calls a fixed coefficients model, but it's close. I won't try to explain that. thank you, yeah. But it's close in the sense that it's complicated and the complementarities are such that you can make very big mistakes by sort of looking at the measurement. I'll give you two other examples. Information technology started developing in a big way in the advanced countries right after World War II. There's famous stories about this. Watson said the steady state number of computers would be 3. That was a brilliant prediction. Economists tried to measure the impact of information technology for 30 years and got nothing, or next to nothing. And then with the internet, the connectivity of servers and stuff, it all of a sudden started to show up and, you know, explains a good chunk of the 3% productivity growth we've had. That doesn't mean nothing was happening before, but if you sort of get into that story, you realize that the economic impact required what we now associate with the various versions of the internet and the World Wide Web. Development economists try to measure the impact of education by doing various sophisticated kinds of regressions. They turn up either mixed or negligible results. Now, that doesn't accord with anybody's intuition, nor would anybody sensible make a policy decision on that empirical result. It's the same explanation. It shows up as apparently useful in some environments and not in others, because the ones where it isn't useful are ones that are missing some other pieces. This is my plea for faith. I think you should assume that both education and information technology and its various multiple aspects are going to turn out, when the historians get at it, to be terribly important and sort of get on with it and not worry terribly much about the measurement. If I were going to suggest a subset of things that to focus on, if for those who are interested, and I realize there's multiple values and objectives here. We confronted this in the Growth Commission all the time. We had to ask questions like, what does the investment in health have to do with growth? Well, the first thing that, you know, somebody will say to you when you sort of ask that question is, well, people care about health, and independent of growth. And the answer to that is yes, not hand-waving, just yes. And so that's what societies do. They make, as Marcia has studied in detail, societies make collective choices about, you know, how those things get translated into the allocation of resources and so on. But for me, I'm going to focus on the growth and development part. You heard me say yesterday, so I won't repeat it at great length, which is, assuming certain preconditions are there, development is without exaggerating terribly much, is a process of acquiring knowledge, not just in individuals, but in systems, how to do things. It's a learning process. So I get nervous when I hear the term knowledge economy, because I think the image that goes with that is, well, it's sort of, you know, stopping manufacturing and, you know, moving bits and bytes around and the financial system and, you know, and creating new things and all that. And I guess what I want to say is I think it's actually a continuum. You know, the process of development is, and you can see this clearly. I mean, if I worked in a developing country, say India, I would be paid probably a fifth of what I might have been paid if I decided to get paid, you know, working in an advanced country. That's not because I'm different. It's because the environment determines my economic value in that setting. If I were going to focus, I would stay with the education and what this difficult challenge has to do with improving the effectiveness and efficiency of education. I think that's terribly important. I would certainly focus on health and try to get a grip on it. In all of these things, you know, one is there's innovation going on all the time, and so you are studying a moving target. And so I think you might as well just accept that. The third area I picked off, and I don't mean this to be exhaustive at all, but it is, I guess somebody wrote in one of the two pagers, sort of e-government, and I think that is terribly important because the access to services, some of which must be provided by government, has to become much more efficient and inclusive. And I think that has two parts. One is services provided by government, and the other one is, this is rather newer, and I think some of you have sort of looked into this, but which is evaluation of government, feedback to government. It's a two-way process of continuous improvement. Final thought on this general thing is I may be wrong in this, but I believe there's a danger in implicit assumptions. We carry around with us sort of all the time implicit models of things, and we frequently don't state what they are. And a lot of debate seems to me to be about different ways of thinking about how the world works as opposed to the specifics. You see this all the time in development. You think there's a disagreement about policy, it's actually a disagreement about the underlying sort of model that somebody's working. And sometimes that extends to values. Couple of final thoughts. I want to endorse what Rohinton said. A huge important application of modern information technology that does affect everybody, including the developing world, is the global supply chains on the one hand and the financial system on the other. What many of us think is the excessive trading superstructure in the financial system is essentially impossible without the information technology. I don't think you necessarily want to go off in this direction, but somebody is going to have to think carefully about the stability of systems that run on this kind of thing. This is way too, we can't go this direction, but at least not for long. But the instability we just experienced that affected every single person in the world was an instability that wasn't seen by anybody, or at least not accurately, and that's because the models are way behind the actual structure. So financial markets have a rapidly evolving network structure that has to do with the way balance sheets are connected. And there is neither theory nor data available to sort of help you understand that. So I think that might be an interesting sort of addition. Last comment is, I think, Rohinton, you said it would be nice to have some kind of assessment of the crisis. As exactly the moment you said it, I glanced at my email, and I just got the draft of the Special Commission report on the crisis and its impact on developing countries. So hopefully that'll – that's a little marketing here. Hopefully that'll be at least a contribution to that area.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Mike. Greatly appreciated. I am going to be strict with myself, and I'm going to limit my comments because these, according to the schedule, are the last official comments, but I in no way intend to synthesize all this together. I will reinforce something that Rohinton said, and that is that this forum was not convened specifically or explicitly to give direction to IDRC. We brought you folks together into this room because we knew it would be a feeding frenzy of good ideas, and it would inform all of us in our various capacities, and it would just be a rich learning experience for all of us, and that's what the intention was. That said, however, you know, as I indicated at the beginning, IDRC has helped build this field, and we have to be informed by what went on here. And that is certainly the case. IDRC has made a very clear commitment to continuing to build this field, to enhance this field, to look at the transformation from 2006 or when was it, 2003 to 2009. Where are we going to be in 2015? We want to be there, and we will be there. And the idea that IDRC, I think, is very much the idea that IDRC has in how to move forward to 2015 is, in fact, very much in line with the thinking here. We've gone well beyond the consideration of what used to be called access to technology. That's still an issue. No one's downplaying that. But now we're looking at the consequences of the connectivity and the networking, social, physical, and otherwise, that occur as a consequence of connectivity. And so our programming certainly will maintain its focus on ICT4D. It's also going to pay attention to how ICT4D rubrics can be integrated into sectorally based programs as well. So I've heard people talk very strongly about education, health. I would extend that to food security systems, climate change, global governance that we've just talked about. These are areas of research at IDRC that I think are in need of the kind of thinking that's gone on in this room. And so that, and I remember Rohinton said to us at a meeting when I pulled the team leaders from ICT4D into a room in Ottawa and said, okay, here's our chance. We've got half an hour. Let's invent the future. And that's when the notion of openness first came out. And Rohinton came up to speak to us, and he listened to us and listened to us. He said, you know, what you folks are talking about here are concepts that should permeate the entire center. And I remember that very strongly because it seems to me that the breadth and width, the transdisciplinarity of what we're doing, the complexity of it. This is complex science, and we are not going to be fixated the way some other development agencies are on goalposts in the sand and metrics that necessarily indicate whether or not we are succeeding. We do have to ensure that the kind of analysis that we're bringing to the table permeates the center. And so that's how we're going to move forward. That's how important this field has been to IDRC, and how we will continue. That's all I wanted to say. There are just a couple more comments I wanted to make, and I want to really thoroughly embarrass Matt Smith and Laurent Elder, who have put this together in such a way that has led to the richness of the diet that we've been feeding on here. So both of you, thank you so much for doing this, and a little round of applause.
The true architect of all this is really Randy Spence. So the big hand of applause for Randy Spence.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Randy. I mean, this clearly, when you can persuade Rohinton of getting something done, that this is important. This is a skill I want to learn from you. So we'll talk. I have nothing more to say at this point. I know that the dialogue and the trilogues and the four-way conversations and so on will continue. I'm delighted to hear that this is going to appear in a way that will recognize the importance of this globally. So, Mike, this is a tremendous opportunity for this to carry on in perpetuity, and I really thank the journal for that. With that, I'm going to wrap it up and let the conversation continue. Sorry, Inika.
I think Fidi and I still want to have some points to make on the four.
For these, sure, we have time for that.
That's great.
We have time for that. Thank you very much. So, okay, let's open it up. I will keep it relatively short, if that's all right. So, please, let's open it up.
I will, of course, now raise the gender issue again. Yeah. The fact that while we speak, female students in Zimbabwe still do not have access to the university library, and that women in Uganda are holding back and not use the village phone to optimum potential because then they lose their husband, because men can't handle, wealthy women, and village phone is sometimes socially, and so on. All those little vignettes that we have found indicate that we have a real gender problem. And if we do not do anything and pretend it's like a neutral problem, ICT4D, a gender neutral problem, we only get more of this. And I remember that something like this happened in the 70s when there were these so-called gender neutral Western-centric development models taking a role. Playing themselves out, which resulted not only in deprivation of households, but malnutrition of children. Because what was made invisible was the fact that if you focus on the development of male household members and you forget to include women and their development, that families suffer and children will suffer. So I do not think that anybody in this room wants to be part of that. But that is going to be the consequence if we don't kind of include purposefully gender in the ICT4D research agenda. We have to. And it is a bit of a chicken and egg problem, because we also know, and Amartya Sen has been written about it extensively, if you invest in women, you actually benefit general development, because women tend to spend their monies on families, on communities, on their children and everything. And the fact that the example of that these ladies couldn't pay for their tuition because they were missing out on family income, and then to immediately have that concept threatening, like, so it can be done because it's not sustainable. We have to understand that as humanity together, I like to think of us being all in this boat together. We have created a gender unjust world, so maybe we should wait a bit with immediately pushing the whole idea of it has to be sustainable, and in terms of money, of course, because we have a backlog. We have to catch up some things, and women are ready to catch up. We have found that through our research in Africa, and we see it even very, very strong and passionate in the Middle East. We just have to give them a break. Together as humanity, through the way we thought, we have created this world, and it's a very unjust world, and it's totally sexist. So I think before we kind of slap the whole idea of it has to be sustainable and money has kind of a righteous, almost divine voice in the whole matter, we have to realize what we have created and that, that we don't want more of this. We want something different. And the last point when it comes to gender. I have also realized that even for people who are not interested in ICD as such, ICTD research is great gender research opportunity. Because what I've realized is that they are such powerful tools, they are affecting everybody's life on the whole planet, and they function like scratch cards. You know, like children play with scratch cards, and you scratch and suddenly the painting becomes visible. It was invisible before, but you scratch and it becomes visible. Like for instance, women in Zambia, and not only one, are killed because they have a mobile phone, and they have their own social network out of their husband's control. So that gender reality always existed, right? Now it becomes visible because now it's a mobile phone and it's getting way out of hand. This is now so much freedom, her husband cannot control it anymore. This is just one dramatic example. But I see it everywhere. ICTD4D is a massive opportunity to not only benefit the ICTD4D potential for women and their families and their communities, but to have an entrance in a lot of gender injustice that is currently really going on. So that's it.
Thank you, Inika. Ophelia.
I don't mean to take you back, but I thought we came up with the idea that ICTs are for reduction of poverty, however you describe it. And the more I hear about not, perhaps I'm in a box myself, but when you're looking at ICTs for what? I think my concern is if we do not accept certain types of indicators that we've been using in the past, what do we use in order to measure the impact of the ICTs? So the question is, I think there is a point where we have to develop new indicators. For example, I like the connectivity part of it. That was never part of the traditional indicators. Or the quality of life, like the comfort zone, for example, is better. So there is, I think, room for looking at indicators of impact in order to show that ICTs can contribute towards development. It's just maybe looking at it with the new glasses or new vision, if you like. But I don't think we can get away from the concept of seeing to what extent. Why do we use ICTs, or why should people use ICTs?
Thank you, Ophelia. Bill, and then Ethan.
One of the points that hasn't received enough emphasis in the discussion is the role of history and evolution and what all the latest developments in ICT that we have been focusing on build on what their predecessors have been. And it was actually David Malone's comment that brought this home to me, because 35 years ago, I was doing research on satellite communication in Canada, when Canada was a leader in satellite development and indeed supported and stimulated the use of satellites in India and a number of other countries. It's not that this hasn't been part of the research, and many people here have contributed to that, but it hasn't been part of the discussion here. And I think very much the implications depend on the state of affairs in communities and countries before we address the current issues relating to the newer technologies. And very often the inherited circumstances determine more what happens than the new addition to the developments. Which does remind me that in a discussion over the coffee break, Heloise asked me, could I define information economy or knowledge society? To which my answer was, we have always had information societies and knowledge economies. The only thing that's changed is the information communication and the electronic forms of generating, distributing, and applying the knowledge, and that the economic classification is a fairly simplistic one, simply looking to how resources are allocated, whether it's mostly toward agriculture, industry, or we would say information knowledge-based activities. And that, in turn, raises the question that the implications that people are studying do relate to a change in the knowledge structure within localities. And very often we get some negative effects when we introduce a new technology. Something that has been demonstrated over and over again with a new technology introduced into a small community, whoever gets to control access to that technology, the power increases dramatically. At a national level, we know that whenever something new is introduced, the asymmetries and disparities are automatically increased because those who can take advantage of that benefit and those who can't don't. And it is the developing countries that don't. And I think at the present time, we are at a transition point. The focus so far has been on liberalizing the telecommunication industry and on the convergence of the ICT sector of different industries. And now the focus is shifting to applications. And the reason it's shifting to applications is because in the developed countries, we've pretty much solved the infrastructure problem, right? We still have to roll out broadband, but we all have our broadband programs. We're rolling it out. So access is there. It's almost there. So let's move on and look at applications in health and education and all kinds of industry. That is the next move. But if we look at developing countries, they're still back in stage one mostly. They're reforming their telecommunication system. They're dealing with the elementary problems of convergence. And that is still the major issue. And if that isn't solved, then there can't be very good applications in those countries. But I think there's a very good opportunity because the applications can be a catalyst for the infrastructure development in developing countries. Some of the literature is referring to these developments as the development of anchor tenants. So as donor agencies and other investors are now thinking about how do we apply health in a developing country where there is an inadequate telecommunication system, then that health need can be the focus for actually getting a telecommunication system developed and access to the other ICTs, but only if they're addressed together. And what disturbs me is I see a number of developments recently, particularly in the health field, where you're finding health inputs are going into developing countries and creating a health delivery program that involves the actual construction of a telecommunication link for that health program when the community that they're serving has no effective telecommunication-based services at all. And I think if that is the nature of the development, then I predict the health initiatives will end up the same way the telecenter initiatives ended up. And unless these things are integrated, then I think the next step is going to have severe difficulty. And I'm very much concerned because the development agenda is driven by the developed countries, and they're now focusing almost entirely on applications. And unless the conception is viewed more broadly to actually ensure that the infrastructure gets developed in developing countries, we're going to repeat our mistakes of the past. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill. Ethan.
I was struck by something that Rahinson said in summing up, and it was basically a framing of two stories, one from the last forum, one from this forum. Last time, the notion of the power of deploying the mobile phone in Bangladesh. This time, Professor Sen's story about the use of the mobile phone to change political opinion in Pakistan. And what I was struck by was actually how little we talked about that particular nexus of mobile phone and television, or maybe even more broadly, interactive technologies and broadcast technologies. I've been making the case for some years now, based on my experiences in West Africa, that the combination of community radio plus mobile phones gets you about 70% of what you'd like to get out of the internet. And while that's a cheap throwaway line and you can't actually support all of it, what I mean by that is that what you want is the ability for people to express themselves, make their voices heard, and have it heard by a large audience in some way to get some fashion of feedback mechanism. And so with that, I was particularly happy to hear Dr. Spence raise this idea of ICT as a way of providing feedbacks to government. I found myself about a year ago in the unusual situation of sitting down with a group of internet innovators in Dubai, attempting to give a summary of 4 days of discussion on the future of the internet to the Sheikh of Dubai. And we were dealing with the very awkward situation that we'd just been in United Arab Emirates for 4 days. None of us could check many of the essential services we relied on online because the country's so heavily censored. And we'd spent much of our time passing back and forth anti-censorship technologies. And we were trying to figure out how you make the case to someone who's simultaneously trying to introduce a digital Dubai that there's an absurdity to this without being flat out rude, which might have in fact been the thing to do. And what we ended up doing was talking about the notion of homeostasis, that within a living organism, to be able to adapt to your environment, you need feedback of what's actually going on so you can change natural processes. If your feedback mechanism breaks, or in some ways even worse, lies to you, you can find yourself very, very ill and unable to adapt to your environment. Your body suddenly concludes that the temperature in this room is 150 degrees. You sweat uncontrollably. This is an unhealthy way for things to happen. One of the major functions of ICT over the next decade, and frankly, one of the functions of communication technologies in general, is to help actors, whether it's community groups, whether it's states, whether it's corporations, understand and get feedback from the people that they're serving. And as we start thinking about the nexus of how technologies work together, I would urge people not necessarily to over-focus purely on the interactive technologies. What we're really looking for is this nexus between interaction and the ability to broadcast out to a wide range so that those functions come into play. With that, I'm going to make sort of my final plea, which is a plea as we start thinking forward to think within this frame of citizen media. The idea that we're not just using ICT to educate ourselves, we're not just using ICT for economic opportunity, but we're using ICT to create public spaces and to identify the issues that we actually have to collectively address. I've had the fascinating experience today. I'm sort of watching at the same time as I'm participating in this some very strange political developments going on around Madagascar. The coup leader of Madagascar was scheduled to speak at the UN today, which would have been a hugely legitimating function. It essentially would have legitimated Rajoelina as the leader of the country rather than Ravalomanana. There's been ongoing protests in the streets of New York, and especially online, organized over blogs and over Twitter. And the victory that came across about 45 minutes ago was the fact that, for reasons we still don't understand, Rajoelina was not, in fact, allowed to speak. He was passed over in the speaking order. Now, this is a very strange, very subtle process. It's something that you would miss entirely. But what's gone on is essentially people in this country have found a way to create a public space when other public spaces, notably broadcast television and other government-controlled media, have been effectively shut down to them. And it's become a space for organizing and a space for questioning legitimacy of what is frankly an illegitimate government. As we move forward, those concerns about how we use these technologies to create those public spaces, to give feedback to whatever institutions we're creating and to right the wrongs, has to be part of our development debate.
Thank you, Ethan, very much for that. Clotilda.
Yes, a couple of comments concerning policy definition and this concern that Lawrence brought up in relation to incentives or interventions. And I think that having been close to government and having been close to civil society, my experience would lead to the consideration of what I would call a halfway through a option, which would be demonstration projects. The reason why I mention is that I understand the complexities of full implementation of complex projects, as you mentioned in the case of telecenters and projects that had that type of support. And I certainly understand the value of incentives of different types, both market incentives and other types of incentives. But when people are in government and when they're defining policy, they're working in very short time spans, 4 years, 6 years at the most. They want to bring about change. They need information. As someone was saying here, the Chinese came looking for knowledge, not for resources. But how do you go about defining as a government agency or as a ministry or someone who wants to bring about change the directions in which you're going to move? And when you're dealing about ICTs in different areas or digital technologies, there are great risks. You have to be able to pull projects of a nature that really have national impact. You have to take risks. And very frequently, politicians are not so inclined to take in risks beyond a certain level. So I think that what we have seen in Costa Rica and as an organization of the third sector has done is to generate projects that are not pilot projects but demonstration projects that allow you to put into a concrete sphere initiatives that are very forward-looking, that are very interesting, that governments would take long time to develop and even longer time to scale up and generalize, but that can allow people who make decisions, who can make decision investment or policy decisions, to look at something which is functioning very well, to see it in very concrete terms, and to be inspired or moved or just committed to make that grow. And we've done that in several cases. Perhaps one of the most interesting and successful has been a project in the creation of digital firms and entrepreneurship initiatives with the generation of computer-mediated simulations so that young people can learn to operate a business and to play the role of entrepreneurs in very modern learning experiential contexts. We did an initial project in three high schools, and then it moved into the national program, and now it's going to all high schools that have entrepreneurship programs. But selling the idea of this initiative would have been too complicated. Making it, having an investment for research and development so that this exists and you can generalize it, I think really makes a wonderful difference and can allow you then to take it to other countries, to share it in different areas. This project in particular had a support from IDRC, and then we took it to Central America. And we did not work in high schools in Central America. We worked in communities. And we added to the initiative in the area of entrepreneurship elements of citizenship development and how entrepreneurship and citizenship mix. But it exists. You know, it's something that people defining and making decisions can see. And I think that would perhaps be sort of a type of initiative that would allow for important investment in that respect. The other thing I wanted to mention is this issue of the knowledge economy. I fully agree that knowledge has, you know, from the beginnings of history and even perhaps before that, being a fundamental element of everything human beings do. I think that for that very reason, symbolic capacity is so fundamental. But those who have studied the changes brought about by telecommunications and new technologies in depth, Manuel Castells, for example, has devoted a significant part of his research work and very serious research work to this topic, has made a very important statement or definition in the sense that today, he says, Manuel Castells says, the human mind is a direct productive force, not only a decisive element in the production system. And I think that this is something we need to think about, or at least from the perspective of an institution that deals with the creation of opportunities for the young and deals in learning and education, we have to take into consideration. It's not only that knowledge is important for production, it is that knowledge is now, the mind is a force in the production system in ways that it was not in the past. So I think that having that perception forces us to see these processes in new ways so that we can really generate initiatives that can strengthen that power of the mind, especially in the developing world, to bring about innovation and change at the local level and to connect with what is happening in other spheres. And I think that that's a very important ethical responsibility that we have. It is an issue that has to be with economic development, with social development, but it certainly has to do with equity and human justice.
Thank you, Clotilde. I have David and then Allison. Are there others? Okay, well, David, over to you.
Thank you, and I'll try to be brief because I know we're running out of time and a number of people need to leave. I was very happy to hear Anita talk a bit about social organization and the importance of it in India and the reality that, frankly, it preceded ICTs. It was playing a very important role before ICTs. It may take advantage of ICTs, but frankly, ICTs are going to be relatively marginal in terms of social organization. Again, they're going to be a tool rather than playing a much more significant role on that. So, Anita, thank you for that. Secondly, I wanted to say how ahistorical our media often is when writing about ICTs. There's a tremendous rush of enthusiasm over the role that SMS has played in the recent demonstrations in Iran. And cell phone networks did play an important role in terms of the means of communication. But actually, the recent demonstrations in Iran reminded me of nothing more than the demonstrations 30 years ago in Iran, which were organized slightly differently, but in every other respect were very, very similar. Third, I wanted to come to risks arising out of ICT networks and so on. It's very reassuring to have Ethan and other activists in the room who worry about human rights, because actually, I think we don't worry enough about human rights and the risks involved in ICT enabled communication, in the sense that governments which are inherently authoritarian and always very fearful of new approaches and technologies they don't understand are working very hard to get on top of these technologies in terms of surveillance and all the rest of it. It's moving very fast, as far as I can make out. I have some friends in the legal field who are working on aspects of this. So in that sense, I was reassured to find that the enthusiasms around this table were moderated by concerns of that nature. But having been alive even longer than a number of you, I'm convinced we need to be actually very concerned on that front, not just in the developing world. It's a global phenomenon. Governments always like to know everything and to be in control of as much as they can be. And ICT-driven communication gives them lots of opportunities.
Thank you, David. Allison.
Thank you. I just wanted to pick up on a few of the points that were made in the closing, because I think they, and to the previous session, because I think the point has been made that we've all actually come here with assumptions and values that are not always explicit, and I think that's absolutely true. And I really don't want to belabor the whole state market thing, because I think we've gone over it extensively. But I think the point that I was making, as opposed to historical polarization of these two, is that in order to get things to work in developing countries, in order to alleviate poverty, we have to get all of these things to work. So it was particularly trying not to dichotomize these, not to fall into sort of statist arguments or into market arguments. And I think that goes to Rohinton's point about you're making the value proposition. But it's not just about making the same value proposition we have before, which is correct, that I think, that you know, if you reduce taxes and you do certain things, you can actually get the market to grow in your favor and you'll get additional money into your fiscus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and make the case. But also to more clearly than we have in the past from a research point of view, define the role of government and market and civil society at this point of development, and the changing nature of it. So I think historically our value proposition has been, you've done a really rotten job up to now, you don't have the resources to do it properly anyway, so you know, let the market do it, and there'll be a benefit, there'll be a runoff sort of, you know, at the end, and you can sort of pick that up. Whereas I'm saying, I think what we need to show, we need to make a far clearer case about how essential it is for governments to work, to have functional institutions in order for markets to work, in order for those other things to work. So I didn't want to leave with the impression that Anita raised about, you know, that notions like the government, you know, actually must pay for the things that it should pay for, and one shouldn't just sort of, you know, use the market to pick up the, or the private sector to pick up those things. I think in our what might distinguish our research from some of the straight sort of academic research that's gone on is that we are doing policy work, we are doing real work. We actually want to see real outcomes, not sort of, you know, theoretical or morally correct outcomes necessarily. We want to actually see what's working and what's not. And I think the really important part over the last few years is actually the development of evidence-based policy. So when, you know, you say, well, you know, if this is important, government should pay. How are they going to pay for it? How do resource-constrained developing countries do things? Because if you just do them the way they were done in terms of best practice in the north, they're not going to work. If you set up very complex regulatory agencies around competition regulation that requires 17 economists to actually do significant market power studies in order to check whether the person should be regulated or not before you do the thing, instead of a simple benchmarking tariff exercise that could actually reduce those rates and bring services to people more quickly. You know, it's those kinds of things that we are trying to develop research and strategies and policies that arise from real circumstances that are out there that actually say, in resource-constrained environments, what can governments do? What can't they do? Because if they don't do it, it's simply not going to get done. Or if the market doesn't do it, it's simply not going to get done. So I just wanted to say, I'm you know, I'm not a fully reconstructed Marxist myself. So it's not you know, that I'm sort of trying. I'm saying, let's move away from those. Let's make those assumptions explicit. Let's actually say what the values are and what we think, what works and what doesn't. And this is actually the pragmatism and the evidence that we need in order to get markets, but also states to work in these countries. And I just wanted to make that point because I think it goes a little bit to the last point that David was making. And I really must disagree. Of course there's been social organization before, and of course there's been wisdom and knowledge before. You know, I think, you know, nobody can contest that. But the way that these people are going to get access to them, the way new technologies can be used in order to, you know, disseminate them more widely, to gain access, etc., are going to be very significant. I mean, I think it was implicit, if not explicit, in what Michael Spence was saying, is that there is a fundamental revolution here. And it's going to affect how people are able to influence things, how they're able to participate in the economy and society as citizens and as consumers. They are both. We cannot deny that citizens are consumers. A lot of the outcomes that we see in our countries is because markets have been allowed to enter and do things that governments failed to do for 50 years. And we didn't have telecommunications in Africa for 50 years, 1%. And, you know, in the last 10 years, we've got a lot more. Through the exploitation of the market, and indeed, it's not been adequately regulated. We've got very high prices. You know, there's a lot of government failure around it, but I'm saying we need to address that as well. So I think we will see a significant role of ICTs in social organization. We will see a significant role of ICTs in economic strategies and growth and organization. And we will see it in political organization. And what we need to do is find the ways to do that more effectively through the e-government mechanisms, et cetera, to extend those things to the poor. So I just think the ICT, the understanding the ICT role in these very important developments should be a core part of our research endeavor.
Thank you very much, Allison. I have Randy and then Mike. And Uno. Okay, Randy first.
But Michael, I think we need to wrap up.
Yeah, we will. We'll go. So please go very quickly. Randy, Uno, and then Mike, and then that's it.
I have sort of three little non-substantive points, so maybe I'll do it last.
Okay, thank you. Uno.
Okay, this will be very quick. I'm not really on research, more on the communication department. If you have any good research or you see good on-the-ground activities, not necessarily funded by IDRC, it would be nice to be able to share with others in the other countries. So it's create a trust in the other countries to adopt that kind of approach and hope we can learn from others that way. So it's really, if you can talk to the communication department to share the field experience from other countries, that will be helpful. The problem is language maybe, because most of your stuff may be in English. It's difficult for us in Indonesia to comprehend. It would be nice to be able to translate some of this into the local language. Thank you.
Oh no, I hear you very strongly. Thank you for that. Mike.
Oh, I just had a quick thought that because we didn't talk about it related to what Clotilde was saying. You know, apart from the things we all know that the modern information technology and the internet and all that deliver, probably the biggest single economic effect is what is variously described as the burgeoning trade in services. You know, knowledge and sort of transaction and information and creativity intensive things, and the crushing of the boundaries of the geographic boundaries of labor markets. I mean, this is a huge trend, and it's only really just begun. Now it is intersectable by language things. The thought I wanted to leave you with is this is in my judgment, an extremely underexploited possibility in domestic economies. We've been saying this in China for a long time. There's a lot of remote areas, and there's just a huge opportunity to do this domestically as well as internationally. That's how it started. In the United States, the first outsourcing was credit card servicing that went to Nebraska. You know, so it's just another very large item on the agenda that might figure in the research. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mike. Randy, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Three little things that may or may not be interesting to IDRC. The first is that although I did a lot of work on this, the idea for the Second Harvard Forum was really Rohinton's. So we do need to talk, Michael. And and maybe it brings us back to these ideas of persistence and long-term relationships. The second is that although we thank Matt Smith, I wanted to add that he did for this meeting a lot of what I did for the first meeting, and then kind of stood aside, and although he has a lot of very interesting things to say, didn't. Talk, so I'm hoping he'll take a much bigger profile in the third Harvard Forum. And finally, I think on behalf of all of us, I want to thank you and IDRC for spearheading this and for playing such a large part in this field. Thank you.
So, with that, thank you again.
I see you in Dakar.
In Dakar.
Dakar.